Chapter 5. Idris. Roshu Admin's holding cells were in one of the more civilized neighborhoods of Roshu Primator. Reaching the docking ring and the Vulture God was going to involve some legwork through districts where a little violence could be overlooked. Idris was painfully aware just how big and healthy those two thugs of Ascaro's had been. Rollo could throw a punch, and Chris was more than capable of looking after herself, but neither of them were professional heavies.
"Listen up, my children,"
Rollo was speaking low, sending to all crew.
"Extricate yourselves from whatever foul vices you're engaged in, and hightail it back to the god right now. We are no longer welcome here. Keep an eye out for Voyenne in green too."
"Are we fighting now?" came Barney's incredulous reply. "I mean, already?"
"No, my son. We are flying ahead of the shitstorm, like always,"
Rollo told him.
"Ollie?"
"Does this mean no shore leave for me?" the drone specialist's voice broke in.
"My poor luckless daughter, it does,"
Rollo confirmed.
"And I need the god ready for a speedy exit. Especially if bad neighbours turn up before we do."
Ollie's response to that was anatomically challenging, but probably indicated agreement.
"Kittering?"
Rollo was striding down the dignified street at an undignified hustle, heedless of the stares they were getting. Two dirty spacers plus Chris, whose ersatz finery looked like the imitation it was in this district. There was a rattle over the comms, then the translation chirped, "Scurrying in progress." Converting Hanny to human Colval was more of an art than a science.
"Tell me we have somewhere to go, Kit."
"Further employment has been secured through my own excellent offices, Captain. Good work, low risk," Kittering's translator yapped.
"Anywhere but here,"
Rollo confirmed, as they hit the seedier side of town and prepared for trouble.
"This way, children."
He bundled Idris and Chris onto a cargo elevator.
"Next time, my daughter, bring backup for a caper like this. See you right?"
"I did take out some fight insurance, what with you being incommunicado," Chris confessed.
She had authority in emergencies, but ceding control made Rollo twitchy.
"Seeing how the Boyarin get violent when they don't get what they want, I hired us some extra security."
At his glower, she added, "A concerned party who alerted me to your predicament, Captain, and offered their services."
"We are going to have a talk about what your executive authority actually covers," Rollo muttered.
But then the elevator shuddered to a halt at a loading bay. They bulled their way out through a crowd of spacers and staff, all apparently trying to manoeuvre bulky A-grav crates and trolleys towards it at the same time. Idris caught a flash of bottle green uniform.
"Trouble," he hissed.
A couple of Voyenne were shoving through the throng towards them. Rollo nodded and vaulted the next cargo flatbed, heading away. But before Idris could follow, a third Voyenne loomed abruptly beside him. A big man in shirt sleeves, no doubt dragged from some dive by his master's demands. For a moment, he had Idris's collar, hoisting the smaller man off the ground. Then Chris's knife flashed out, its ceramic blade slashing the man's wrist, so he let go with a howl.
"Now we run."
Their undignified hustle abruptly became a flat-out pelt over cargo crates and around startled haulers and loaders. Rollo jinked towards another elevator, but the car was already departing, and Idris saw another Voyenne elbowing towards them from that quarter, a head taller than most of the crowd. There was only a railing in the opposite direction, surrounding a deep shaft. It had been built to transport containers into the bowels of the city from the docking ring above, and also housed the cargo elevator in which they'd arrived. Idris remembered seeing shafts like that as a child. It had seemed that you could step out into empty air and float down, just like those monolithic cargo pods, except that each pod was controlled by the city's gravitic engines. Jump out into that abyss, and you'd plummet to your death. Chris swore and whirled towards the approaching Voyeni, knife at the ready. But her scarf seemed to strike up a life of its own, tugging her towards the railing and the drop. She swore and swatted at the hand-like remote plucking at her.
Get with the program, on,
Medvig signalled. Their remote sprang from Chris to land on an automated pallet stacked high with containers as it glided slowly alongside the shaft, a ton of stately metal in motion. Rollo didn't hesitate, hauling Idris onto the pallet. A line of nacelles jutted from its upper surface, handles for gravitic steering, and Idris grimly wrapped his arms about one. Rollo boosted Chris up, then scrambled aboard himself. The Voyeni were already running, not seeing the plan, but scenting there was one, and they now wielded short, studded bludgeons. Matters had gone past mere fisticuffs. The pallet reversed dramatically, shunting pedestrians out of the way until it hit the buckling metal of the rail.
Grab on, organics, Medvig chattered in their ears. Rough transit alert.
Without warning, they broke through the rail, dropping into five stories of empty space. Idris heard panicked screams as they began to plummet. A stomach-wrenching second later, and they were climbing back up the shaft, the pallet clawing for purchase against the city's gravitic field.
Medvig, my children, you better all know what you're doing,
Rollo yelled.
In times of stress, have you considered singing happy songs?
Medvig, as an intelligence distributed across a knot of cyborg roaches, loved highlighting human frailties. They passed the platform they'd just abandoned, and the Voyeni were there waiting for them.
Surely they're not going to...
But they were angry, and their boss probably took failure out of their hides. One of them, the boldest or maddest, vaulted the crumpled rail. He hit the floating truck hard, one hand closed tight around the gravitic pontoon. Chris slashed the shoulder seam of his coat, drawing a little blood, but he hauled himself up, the truck lurching madly as his weight skewed its lift calculations. In moments, the second Voyeni had gone for the leap. He'd left it almost too late, hands grabbling for purchase and boots kicking as he tried to pull himself up. Rollo fainted at the first thug, who blocked the punch contemptuously, receiving a blow to his gut as payment. Then he was on Rollo, lifting his opponent with the clear intention of just throwing him into the chasm. Medvig's remote jabbed metal finger legs at his eyes, and the Voyeni reeled back. One huge fist caught the spidery machine and dashed it against a container's metal lid, smashing it into fragments. The Voyeni's other hand still gripped Rollo, and the man looked strong enough to lob the captain into the void one-handed. Chris stabbed him. She looked ice cold for the three heartbeats it took to drive her dueling knife into his ribs four times, then horrified as the man toppled away. Rollo went with him. Idris twitched to grab him and almost toppled from the wildly skewing container himself. It was Chris who snagged Rollo's wrist, bracing herself with a leg over the corner of the container. All of this had their conveyance skewed almost 45 degrees from level, with everyone clinging to its uppermost edge to keep them from the chasm below. At that point, the other Voyeni hauled himself up. Idris kicked him in the face, resulting only in a snarl from his victim as he reached inside his jacket. Idris saw the stubby barrel of a gun, not a high-velocity accelerator, but a laser or chemical firearm that would be quite sufficient to kill any or all of them. Something swung overhead, and he had the sense of an armoured figure with stubby wings, gravity handles just like the pallet's pontoons. The Voyeni jerked his arm up, appreciating the greater threat was above. But the flying figure dipped in the air, grabbed the thug's collar, and jerked sideways, tearing the man off the container and into open air. Idris winced, waiting for the drop. But the flyer swung its victim over a railing into a knot of gawking officials and space crew. Its work done, it ascended to hover above them, keeping perfect pace.
"Is that..." Rollo stammered. "Chris Child, what did you do?"
You couldn't mistake that armour. Grey-blue metal and armour plastic plate. A uniform that had been refined since the war, but never really changed. Everyone knew the elite soldiers of the Parthenon, but you didn't expect to just run into one inside the primate house.
"Meet your new crewmate,"
Chris shouted. Then they were up top, outside the dome, and next to the docking ring. Past the lumpy, repair-scarred hull of an ore transporter, and another couple of haphazardly parked ships, was the reassuringly ugly hull of the Vulture God.
"Yes!"
Rollo whooped. Then their container lurched and tipped them all off. They'd just about hit the dock, rather than plummeting down the shaft, before Medvig abandoned the pallet to its fate. For a moment, it was beginning the long, slow tumble towards the shaft's distant reaches, clanging thunderously off nearby traffic. Then, the city's system caught up with it, cushioning its fall with invisible hands.
"More bad guys, move!"
came Ollie's voice in their ears, and they pelted past the ore freighter towards the Vulture.
"Everyone aboard!"
Rollo demanded.
"Full compliment, aye," she confirmed, "or will be when you get your behind through the hatch."
"Ahead!"
Chris shouted. Idris, already feeling at least 3 decades too old for any of this, saw that the ordeal was nowhere near over. Another 4 Voyeni were charging towards them, emerging from the far side of the Vulture God. It hadn't exactly been a mystery where they'd been docked. They had guns, and they had strength and training on their side even without those. What Idris had was a friend, apparently. Even as they ran for the Vulture, the armoured flyer dropped down, blocking the oncoming Voyeni's path. One of the thugs had a gun levelled now, and in response, the Partheni unslung her own weapon from its holding arms. An accelerator, about as absurdly illegal in this system as anything could be. If she'd turned it downwards, she could have sent a hail of gravitically accelerated pellets through the city's dome, and a score of its separate floors. Still, there was only one of her and 4 Voyeni, who might also consider themselves the galaxy's elite. Not to mention they were all twice the bulk of the women inside the armour. They began spreading out, grim looks on their long faces, determined to do right by their chief. Then, the Vulture's hatch opened, and Ollie joined the fight. Ollie couldn't wear prosthetics or take grafts, born without any awareness of how those absent limbs might work. Instead, she had embraced the unnatural. She called the work frame she wore her Scorpion, designed by the Castigar and never intended for human use. It stomped out on 4 legs, half a dozen tool arms flanking her central pod. A couple of big pincer limbs arched down from the top, and a long segmented tail lashed from side to side behind her. She'd fitted that with a grabber and cutting saw, which struck sparks from the docking platform. In her Scorpion, Ollie was 3 metres tall. The Voyeni looked from her to the Partheni warrior and obviously decided they were outclassed. Mulishly, they backed off as the rest of the crew hustled to board their ship.
"Get us up!"
Rollo bellowed.
"And fuck docking control if they try to complain!"
"Oh, I think they're very glad to be rid of us," Chris said. Idris could only nod weakly, dropping into the pilot seat. He set the Vulture's drive against the gravity of the planet below, sending them leaping into the sky, if not like an eagle, then at least like an old bird that would live to see another day.
Right,
Rollo said, when the Vulture God had broken atmosphere and was navigating the orbital debris that cluttered Roshu's night sky.
My children, let us not do that again. I, for one, am too old for shit even vaguely related to that.
Idris hunched awkwardly in the pilot seat. He was swinging the Vulture hand over hand, using its brocator drives, until it was in an orbit high enough for them to escape at the slightest provocation. The Vulture was nobody's idea of a racer, but their foes no longer had an intermediary. Idris would back himself against any pursuit. As part of what they'd made him into, he had an unmatched feel for the contours of space. He just had to open his mind, to feel the texture of the graphitic foam that formed the barrier between the real and unspace, that the greedy little hands of the brocator could latch onto to drag the ship about. More than 300 volunteers had been accepted onto the old wartime intermediary program, so he'd been told. Idris was one of just 30 who'd not only survived, but left sane enough to do the job. The liaison board's post-war hit rate, using convicts and debtors, was only a tenth even of that. The process was also ruinously expensive, even for successes. Doubtless the Boyarin Oscaro had paid well for a fugitive's whereabouts, and now he knew Idris's provenance, he'd be even keener to take possession, legally or otherwise.
How do we stand with ground control?
Rollo demanded. A crap ton of complaints, but no demands so far, though they forfeited our docking deposit, Chris told him.
I want eyes all around. Ollie, my children. A certain Boyarin bastard most definitely did not walk here from Magda. I don't want his ship on top of us before we know it. Barney, how are feathers? Fucking bedraggled, came the engineer's sour voice. We can fly, though.
Where to?
Idris wanted to know.
Kut!
The Hanny hadn't decamped to his chambers yet, and his screens were still flickering with Roshu local adverts. A moment later, he was displaying navigation data, ship specs, their new job's contractual details. The financial incentive was circled. Commercial transactions formed the chief common ground for human and Hanilambra dealings. Personal enrichment for them was a matter of life and death.
Heading to Huai Kavor, Rollo noticed. Pick a path, Idris. Why does Huai Kavor ring bells with me anyway?
Hegemony takeover in progress, Chris told him promptly. It's going to be a bit turbulent.
Frying pans and fires, and never a break from them.
The captain shook his head.
And while I'm talking trouble, which of my unruly children suborned the city gravitic system to lug us about on that travelling trunk?
Medvig's frame had been standing in the corner like a three-legged avant-garde sculpture. Now, in acknowledgement, they wriggled one of their remotes, currently plugged back into their chest. Rollo scowled at the hiver, but then his expression softened.
I am very grateful, but you can't go about hacking Kybernet systems. It's outside your remit. They'll unlicense you.
Medvig operated under a leash contract of their own, necessary in order to trade with humanity. The colonies, having created the hivers during the war, remained leery of the distributed intelligence now it had declared independence. Medvig's three surviving remotes managed, between them, a very creditable spread-handed shrug. Always a pleasure saving your pounds of flesh, came the artificial voice from their chest. The smile that graced Rollo's face was not one of his jovial beams, but something smaller and more genuine.
Just be careful, see right?
And then he looked up, and his expression hardened. Following his gaze, Idris saw that their newest crewmate had entered the compartment. She still wore most of her armour, though the wings were folded and the gun nowhere to be seen. She was short, compact-framed, her skin weirdly pale. And she was beautiful. Or perhaps she was just a well-finished product of the Partheni Vats. Their warriors weren't identical, but followed an identical aesthetic. She was looking at him, and he knew her. Idris felt a sudden sinking in his belly, knowing that the universe wasn't done messing with him, still ladling out his own personal ration of trouble.
You!
Rollo addressed her, moustache bristling, as he made a big show of being unafraid.
Pulled out your goddamn Mr. Punch inside Roshu Primator. That is death penalty stuff! I should poop you out the airlock right now.
For a moment, the Partheni's face was blank. Then she translated Mr. Punch as spacer slang for an accelerator, so named because of the inconvenient holes it made in ship and habitat walls alike. I am, of course, extremely sorry, she said. Also, you're welcome. Both statements delivered in exactly the same neutral tone of voice, as though giving Rollo the option of which he wanted to hear. In the end, he decided on neither.
Chris, explain this nonsense to your Uncle Rollo, because he can't make head or tail of it.
She came and told me you and Idris had got scrabbled.
The lawyer was cleaning her knife, not quite meeting Rollo's gaze.
She offered herself as security, wanted to sign on. I took an executive decision. And we did need her.
She's a Partheni!
Rollo gesticulated wildly at the woman, then tried to face up to her again.
My newfound surrogate daughter, do you realise we are a crummy little salvage operation here? We are not going to be fighting any star battles while I'm captain.
Sometimes you get tired of fighting, the woman said. Remembering her, Idris didn't believe it for a moment. He should say something, he knew. He should unmask her as the mysterious woman from his past, here for some underhand purpose that could only relate to him. Except something flipped inside him when he looked at her, and in the end he took the coward's way out and said nothing at all.
Well?
Rollo ran a hand through his thinning hair.
What do we even call you? Or do you just have a number?
Solace, Idris recalled, just before she spoke. There had been rank and company after the name back then, and she was plainly biting off something similar now. It must be hard to be just Solace, without all that military armour to protect it. And there was something about that moment when she just said her name, bare and alone. She looked suddenly uncertain, a crack in that Partheni facade. Idris, who sometimes felt he was built entirely out of competing vulnerabilities, valued them in other people.
Hoi, Captain, came Barney's voice. Horizon trouble.
One of the command screens flashed up with the image of a ship just getting underway. It was a conspicuous piece of kit, with a forked hull like two forward curving claws, the ring of its gravitic drive spread like a peacock's tail. Barney identified it as the Raptorid, Boyarin Oscaro's craft.
Flash bastard, Rollo decided.
Do we have a road to Hui?
We do, Idris confirmed, eyes still on Solace.
Then everyone get to your couches for suspension, for we're going under, my family. We have a working spare for our new friend.
Captain, I keep all the spares in working order, Barney's voice said bleakly, because all the regular couches are on the point of falling over.
Then further discussion will wait, Rollo decided. Chris, show the angel where she's to go. Idris?
Ready.
He saw a twitch of frustration cross Solace's face.
Had her recruitment spiel lined up for me.
It seemed depressingly likely that she was just the friendly face of a deal similar to the Boyarin's.
Everyone wants a piece of me. Well, she can at least wait until Hui Kavor before trying it on.
As he pulled the ship a politic distance from the planet before the unspace jump, he called up a quick lowdown of precisely what was happening on Hui Kavor that had Rollo so gloomy, just in case that meant more personal trouble for him too.
Oh yes, it's being taken over by the clams.
Human colonists, in the hopeful days before, had finally met what they most feared. The Essial hegemony was a genuine space empire, complete with conquered species, all dominated by a race of alien overlords. When humanity appreciated what they'd found, they retreated in fear and disarray. Back then, nobody could imagine anything worse than an alien polity with designs on adding humans to their menagerie, which was exactly what the hegemony seemed to represent. Except, as time went on, no warfleet appeared in the skies over Earth or any of its colonies. The hegemony certainly wanted to talk to humanity, and human xenolinguists' best guess was that they wanted to discuss humans bowing to their almighty alien power, or else something would happen, some species-wide calamity. But if the hegemony was threatening humanity, they seemed very laid back about it. Refusal caused no offence, just a repeat of the offer, demand or ultimatum at a later date. It didn't help that the Essiel were very alien aliens, and their conquered underspecies weren't much better. So although the Essiel met with human diplomats and sent messages with great pomp and ceremony, nobody was quite sure what they were saying, what threats were being made, what promises offered. Then the architects came, and suddenly many things about the hegemony became clear. The doom that the Essiel had been waving at humanity was not a threat, but a warning. The hegemony was more than familiar with the architect's predatory designs and could shield planets from their attentions. All they wanted in return was a world to swear itself to them, heart and soul. A dozen human colonies joined the hegemony for this reason, accepting the Essiel as their unquestioned overlords. That rate of defection had slackened since the war ended, of course, but now the Essiel had human underlings to translate for them. Hegemonic diplomats had appeared all over the colonial sphere, pushing their inscrutable master's agenda. Their rule was peace and love, order and harmony, they said. The Essiel were the benevolent autocrats our ancestors had sought but never found, human nature being too flawed. They were a cult, basically. Nobody was even sure if what they spouted really represented what the Essiel and their hegemony intended, filtered as it was through layers of mistranslation. The Essiel were, in a very religious sense, ineffable. Hui Kavor, the Essiel's latest conquest, was busy with ships. So much so that Idris had a momentary flashback to evacuations during the war. Many were getting the hell off planet with whatever they could carry. Other ships were turning up with diplomats, spies, and information hounds
keen to mediotype every development for dispatch on the next packet ship. After a planet-wide vote and years of argument, the population of Hue Kavor had decided to leave Hue for the Esiel hegemony. Hue Kavor was a big win for the Esiel, a prosperous colony. The hegemonic cult had been pushing hard for years, preaching and proselytizing in the open, and likely worse things behind closed doors, to swing public opinion. And nativists and Hue loyalists had been fighting every step of the way, only to fall at the last fence. Even now, Idris gathered from the news feeds, the ceremonial barge of some Esiel overlord was due, come to oversee the ritual obeisance of the colony's government and accept their fealty. And that would be that. Everyone would have to adjust the notional borders of their maps. Hue Kavor would no longer be a human-governed world. "Just promise me," Barney said, actually there in person, as all the Vulture God's systems were good for the next 24 hours. "Whatever this job is, we're not getting involved in that mess." Rollo glanced at Kittering, who fiddled a little ditty with a few of his mouthparts. His screens lit up with happy human faces. The captain just shrugged.
"Our mark is the Umaru. She's out from some hegemony planet I can't even say properly. Freighter, human-built, human-operated. It's in the curio trade. Decent value stuff. She's 39 standard days late and off the throughways. We get her nav data and go hunting the deep void, same as we've done 100 times. Only this time, we might get to be proper heroes and bring back a live crew."
Barney nodded, grudgingly satisfied.
"We got shore leave on planet.
On station only, and when we're back. Too much shit going down right now. Uncle Rollo doesn't risk his family when there's a whole planet changing hands."
Barney accepted that glumly and sloped off. Idris got up and stretched.
"Go get some sleep," Rollo advised.
"Right, of course."
He'd been on the Vulture long enough for them to know that never happened. When he reached his cabin, though, it was already occupied. Looking oddly nervous, Solace was sitting on his bed, waiting for him.